thick with salt and his skin raw from the wind. He pulled back the sheets and climbed in, falling into dreams as his body kept up the sway of the waves and the wind. All night, far above him, the light stood guard, slicing the darkness like a sword. Chapter 4. Once he's extinguished the light at sunrise each morning, Tom sets off to explore another part of his new territory before getting on with the day's work. The northern side of the island is a sheer granite cliff which sets its jaw stiffly against the ocean below. The land slopes down towards the south and slides gently under the water of the shallow lagoon. Besides its little beach is the water wheel, which carries fresh water from the spring up to the cottage. From the mainland, all the way out along the ocean floor to the island and beyond, there are fissures from which fresh water springs mysteriously. When the French described the phenomenon in the 18th century, it was dismissed as a myth. But sure enough, fresh water was to be found, even in various parts of the ocean, like a magic trick played by nature. He begins to shape his routine. Regulations require that each Sunday he hoists the ensign, and he does, first thing. He raises it too when any man of war, as the rules put it, passes the island. He knows keepers who swear under their breath at the obligation, but Tom takes comfort from the orderliness of it. It is a luxury to do something that serves no practical purpose. The luxury of civilization. He sets about fixing things that have fallen into disrepair since the decline of Trimble Doherty. Most important is the lighthouse itself, which needs putty and the astragals of the lantern glazing. Next he gets rotten stone and sands the wood on the desk drawer where it is swollen with the weather, and goes over it with a wolf's head brush. He patches the green paint on the landings where it is scuffed or worn away. It will be a long while before a crew comes to paint the whole station. The apparatus responds to his attention. The glass gleams, the brass shines, and the light rotates on its bath of mercury as smoothly as a skewer, gliding on currents of air. Now and again he manages to get down to the rocks to fish, or walk along the sandy beach of the lagoon. He makes friends with a pair of black skinks which reside in the woodshed, and occasionally gives them some of the chook's food. He's sparing with his rations. He won't see the store boat for months. It's a hard job, and a busy one. The lightkeepers have no union, not like the men on the storeboats. No one strikes for better pay or conditions. The days can leave him exhausted or sore, worried by the look of a storm front coming in at a gallop, or frustrated by the way hailstones crush the vegetable patch. But if he doesn't think about it too hard, he knows who he is and what he's for. He just has to keep the light burning, nothing more. The Father Christmas face, all red cheeks and whiskers, gave a big grin. "Well, Tom Sherborne, how are you surviving?" Ralph didn't wait for a reply before throwing him the fat, wet rope to wind around the bollard. Tom looked as fitted and well after 3 months as any keeper the skipper had seen. Tom had been waiting for supplies for the light and had given less thought to the fresh food which would be delivered. He had also forgotten that the boat would bring post and was surprised when, toward the end of the day, Ralph handed him some envelopes. "Oh, almost forgot," he said. There was a letter from the district officer of the lighthouse service, retrospectively confirming his appointment and conditions. A letter from the Department of Repatriation set out certain benefits recently allowed to returned servicemen, including incapacity pension or a business loan. Neither applied to him, so he opened the next. Commonwealth Bank statement confirming that he had earned 4% interest on the £500 in his account. He left until last the envelope addressed by hand. He could not think of anyone who might write and fit it might be some do-gooder sending him some news of his brother or father. He opened it. "Dear Tom, I just thought I'd write and check that you hadn't been blown away or swept out to sea or anything, and that lack of roads isn't causing you too many problems." He skipped ahead to see the signature. "Yours truly, Isabel Graysmark." The gist of the middle was that she'd hoped he wasn't too lonely out there, and that he should be sure to stop by and say hello before he went off to wherever he was going after his James posting. She decorated the letter with a little sketch of a lightkeeper leaning against his light tower, whistling a tune while behind him a giant whale emerged from the water, its jaws wide open. She had added for good measure, "Be sure not to get eaten by a whale before then." It made Tom smile, the absurdity of the picture. More than that, the innocence of it. Somehow his body felt lighter just to hold the letter in his hand. "Can you hang on a tick?" he asked Ralph, who was gathering things for the journey back. Tom dashed to his desk for paper and pen. He sat down to write before realizing he had no idea what to say. He didn't want to say anything, just send her a smile. "Dear Isabel." Not blown away, or swept any further, out to sea, fortunately. "I've seen many whales, but none has tried to eat me so far. I'm probably not very tasty. I'm bearing up pretty well, all things considered, and coping adequately with the absence of roads. I trust you are keeping local bird life well fed. I look forward to seeing you before I leave Patagers for who knows where in 3 months' time." How should he sign it? "Nearly ready," called Ralph. "Nearly," he replied, and wrote, "Tom." He sealed and addressed the envelope and handed it to the skipper. "Any chance you could post that for me?" Ralph looked at the address and winked. "I'll deliver it in person. Gotta go past that place anyway." Chapter 5. At the end of his 6 months, Tom savoured the delights of Mrs. Mewett's hospitality once again, for an unexpected reason. The Janus vacancy had become permanent. Far from finding his marbles, Trimble Doherty had lost the few he still had, and had thrown himself over the vast granite cliff face at Albany known as the Gap. Apparently convinced he was jumping onto a boat, skippered by his beloved wife. So Tom had been summoned to shore to discuss the post, do the paperwork, and take some leave before he officially took up the job. By now he had proved himself so capable that Fremantle did not bother to look elsewhere to fill the position. "Never underestimate the importance of the right wife," Captain Hustluck had said when Tom was about to leave his office. Old Moira Doherty could have worked the light herself, she'd been with Trimble so long. Takes a special kind of woman to live on the lights. When you find the right one, you want to snap her up quick smart. Mind you, you'll have to wait a bit now. As Tom wandered back to Mrs. Mewett's, he thought about the little relics at the lighthouse. Doherty's knitting, his wife's jar of humbugs that sat untouched in the pantry. Life's gone, traces left. And he wondered about the despair of the man, destroyed by grief. It didn't take a war to push you over that edge. 2 days after his return to Patagers, Tom sat stiff as a whalebone in the Graysmarks lounge room where both parents watched over their only daughter like eagles with a chick. Struggling to come up with suitable topics of conversation, Tom stuck to the weather. The wind, of which there was an abundance, and Graysmark cousins in other parts of Western Australia. It was relatively easy to steer the conversation away from himself. As Isabel walked into the gate afterwards, she asked, "How long do you go back?" 2 weeks. "Then we'd better make the most of it," she said, as though concluding a long discussion. "Is that so?" asked Tom, as amused as he was surprised. He had a sense of being waltzed backwards. Isabel smiled. "Yes, that's so." And the way the light caught her eyes, he imagined he could see into her. See a clarity, an openness which drew him in. "Come and visit tomorrow, I'll make a picnic. And go down by the bay." "Well, should ask your father first, shouldn't I, or your mother?" He leaned his head to one side. "I mean, if it's not a rude question, how old are you?"
"Old enough to go on a picnic."
"And in ordinary numbers that would make you?"
19,
just about. "So you can leave my parents to me," she said, and gave him a wave as she headed back inside. Tom set off back to Mrs. Mewett's with a lightness in his step. Why, he could not say. He did not know the first thing about this girl, except she smiled a lot, and that something inside just felt good. Following day, Tom approached the Graysmarks' house. Not so much nervous as puzzled. Not quite sure how it was that he was heading back there so soon. Mrs. Graysmark smiled as she opened the door. "Nice and punctual," she noted on some invisible checklist.
"Army habits," said Tom.
Isabel appeared with a picnic basket which she handed to him. "You're in charge of getting it there in one piece," she said, and turned to kiss her mother on the cheek.
"Bye, Ma. I'll see you later."
"Mind you keep out of the sun now. Don't want you spoiling your skin with freckles," she said to her daughter. She gave Tom a look which conveyed something sterner than the words. Enjoy your picnic. Don't be too late back.
Thanks, Mrs. Graysmark, we won't be.
Isabel led the way as they walked beyond the few streets that marked out the town proper and approached the ocean.
Where are we going? Asked Tom.
It's a surprise.
They wandered along the dirt road which led up to the headland, bordered with dense, scrubby trees on each side. These were not the giants from the forest a mile or so further in, but wiry, stocky things which could cope with the salt and the blasting of the wind.
It's a bit of a walk. You won't get too tired, will you? She asked.
Tom laughed.
I'll just about manage without a walking stick.
Well, I just thought you don't have very far to walk on, Janice, do you?
Believe me, getting up and down the stairs of the light all day keeps you in trim.
He was still taking stock of this girl and her uncanny ability to tip him a fraction off balance. The trees began to thin out the further they walked, and the sounds of the ocean grew louder.
I suppose Pardigieu seems dead boring, coming from Sydney, ventured Isabel.
Haven't spent long enough here to know, really.
I suppose not, but Sydney. I imagine it is huge and busy and wonderful. The big smoke.
Oh, pretty small fry compared to London.
Isabel blushed.
Oh, I didn't know you'd been there.
That must be a real city. Maybe I'll visit it one day.
You're better off here, I'd say. London's, well, it was pretty grim whenever I was there on furlough. Grey and gloomy, cold as a corpse. I'd take Pardigieu's any day.
We're getting near the prettiest bit.
Oh, I think it's the prettiest. Beyond the trees emerged an isthmus which jutted far out into the ocean. It was a long bare strip of land a few hundred yards wide and licked by waves on all sides.
This is the point of Point Pardigieu's, said Isabel.
My favourite place is down there on the left where all the big rocks are. They walked on until they were at the centre of the isthmus.
Dump the basket and follow me, she said, and without warning she whisked off her shoes and took off, running to the black granite boulders which tumbled down into the water.
Tom caught her up as she approached the edge. There was a circle of boulders, inside which the waves sloshed and swirled. Isabel laid flat on the ground and leaned her head over the edge.
Listen, she said. Just listen to the sound the water makes. It's like in a cave or a cathedral.
Tom leaned forward to hear.
You've got to lie down, she said.
To hear better?
No, so you don't get washed away. Terrible blowhole, this. If a big wave comes without warning, you'll be down inside the rocks before you know it.
Tom lay down beside her and hung his head into the space where the waves echoed and bellowed and washed about.
Reminds me of Janus.
What's it like out there?
You hear stories, but no one much ever actually goes there except the keeper in the boat.
Or a doctor, once. Years ago when a whole ship was quarantined there with typhoid.
It's like, well,
it's like nowhere else on earth, it's its own world.
They say it's brutal, the weather. It has its moments.
Isabel sat up.
Do you get lonely?
Too busy to be lonely, there's always something needs fixing or checking or recording.
She put her head on one side, half signalling her doubt, but she let it pass.
Do you like it?
Yep. Now it was Isabel who laughed.
You don't exactly yak a lot, do you?
Tom stood up.
Hungry? Must be time for lunch.
He took Isabel's hand and helped her up.
Such a petite hand, soft, with the palm covered in a fine layer of gritty sand. So delicate in his.
Isabel served him roast beef sandwiches and ginger beer, followed by fruitcake and crisp apples.
So do you write to all the light keepers who go out to Janus? Asked Tom.
All? There aren't that many, said Isabel. You're the first new one in years.
Tom hesitated before venturing the next question.
What made you write?
She smiled at him and took a sip of ginger beer before answering.
Because you're fun to feed seagulls with? Because I was bored? Because I'd never sent a letter to a lighthouse before?
She brushed a strand of hair from her eyes and looked down at the water.
Would you rather I hadn't? Oh, no, no, I wasn't trying to, I mean... Tom wiped his hands on his napkin. Always slightly off balance. It was a new sensation for him.
Tom and Isabel were sitting at the end of the jetty at Padajos. It was almost the last day of 1920, and the breeze played tunes by lapping wavelets against the boat's hulls and plucking the ropes on the masts. The harbour lights trailed across the water's surface and the sky was swept with stars.
"But I want to know everything," said Isabel, bare feet dangling above the water. "You can't just say nothing else to tell."
She'd extracted the bare details of his private school education and his engineering degree from Sydney University, but was growing more frustrated.
"I can tell you lots, my gran and how she taught me piano, what I remember about my granddad, even though he died when I was little. I can tell you what it's like to be the headmaster's daughter in a place like Padajos. I can tell you about my brothers, Hugh and Alfie, and how we used to muck around with the dinghy and go off fishing down the river."
She looked at the water. "Still miss those times." Curling a lock of hair around her finger, she considered something, and then took a breath.
"It's like a whole galaxy waiting for you to find out about. And I want to find out about yours."
"What else do you want to know?"
"Well, about your family, say."
"I've got a brother." "Am I allowed to know his name, or have you forgotten it?"
"Well, I'm not likely to forget that in a hurry. Cecil."
"What about your parents?" Tom squinted at the light on top of a mast. "What about them?" Isabel sat up and looked deep into his eyes.
"What goes on in there, I wonder?"
"My mother's dead now. I don't keep in touch with my father." Her shawl had slipped off her shoulder, and he pulled it back up.
"You're getting a bit chilly. You want to walk back?"
"Why won't you talk about it?"
"I'll tell you if you really want. It's just that I'd rather not. Sometimes it's good to leave the past in the past."
"Well, your family's never in your past. You carry it around with you everywhere. More's the pity."
Isabel straightened. "It doesn't matter. Let's go. Mum and Dad'll be wondering where we've got to," she said, and they walked soberly up the jetty.
That night, as he lay in bed, Tom cast his mind back to the childhood Isabel had been so keen to investigate. He'd never really spoken to anyone about it, but exploring the memories now, the jagged pain was like running his tongue over a broken tooth. He could see his 8-year-old self tugging his father's sleeve and crying, "Please, please let her come back, please, Daddy, I love her," and his father wiping his hand away like a grubby mark.
"You don't mention her again in this house, you hear, son?"
As his father stalked out of the room, Tom's brother Cecil, 5 years older and at that stage a good measure taller, gave him a clip on the back of the head.
"Told you, you idiot, I told you not to say it,"
and followed his father with the same officious stride, leaving the small boy standing in the middle of the lounge room. From his pocket, he took a lace handkerchief, redolent with his mother's scent, and touched it to his cheek, avoiding his tears and streaming nose. It was the feel of the cloth he wanted, the perfume, not its use. Tom thought back to the imposing empty house, to the silence that deadened every room with a subtly different pitch, to the kitchen smelling of carbolic, kept spotless by a long line of housekeepers. He remembered that dreaded smell of Lux flakes and his distress as he saw the handkerchief, washed and starched by Mrs. Someone or other, who had discovered it in the pocket of his shorts and laundered it as a matter of course, obliterating his mother's smell. He had searched the house for some corner, some cupboard which could bring back that blurry sweetness of her. But even in what had been her bedroom, there was only polish and mothballs as though her ghost had finally been exorcised. In Padajos, as they sat in the tea rooms, Isabel tried again.
"I'm not trying to hide anything," Tom said. "It's just that raking over the past is a waste of time.
And I'm not trying to pry, only you've had a whole life, a whole story, and I've come in late. I'm only trying to make sense of things, make sense of you."
She hesitated, then asked delicately,
"If I can't talk about the past, am I allowed to talk about the future?"
"We can't rightly ever talk about the future, if you think about it. We can only talk about what we imagine or wish for. It's not the same thing." Okay, what do you wish for then?
Tom paused.
Life. That'll do me, I reckon. He drew a deep breath and turned to her.
What about you?
Oh, I wish for all sorts of things, all the time, she exclaimed. I wish for nice weather for the Sunday school picnic. I wish for, don't laugh, I wish for a good husband and a house full of kids. The sound of a cricket ball breaking a window and the smell of stew in the kitchen. The girls will sing Christmas carols together and the boys will kick the footy. Can't imagine not having children one day, can you? She seemed to drift away for a moment before saying, of course, I wouldn't want one yet. She hesitated. Not like Sarah.
Who?
My friend Sarah Porter. Used to live down the road. We used to play cubbies together. She was a bit older and always had to be mother. Her expression clouded. She got in the family way when she was 16. Her parents sent her up to Perth out of sight. Made her give up the baby to an orphanage. They said he'd be adopted, but he had a club foot. Later she got married and the baby's all forgotten about. Then one day she asked me if I'd come up to Perth with her to visit the orphanage in secret. The infant asylum. Just a few doors down from the proper madhouse. Oh, Tom, you've never seen such a sight as a ward full of motherless tots, and no one to love them. Sarah couldn't breathe a word to her husband. He'd have sent her packing. He has no idea even now. The baby was still there. All she could do was look. Funny thing was, I was the one who couldn't stop crying. The look on their little faces, it really got to me. You might as well send a child straight to hell as send it to an orphanage.
Kid needs its mum, said Tom, lost in a thought of his own.
Isabel said, Sarah lives in Sydney now. I don't hear from her anymore. In those 2 weeks, Tom and Isabel saw each other every day. When Bill Gray's Mike challenged his wife about the propriety of this sudden stepping out, she said,
Oh, Bill,
life's a short thing. She's a sensible girl and she knows her own mind. Besides, there's little enough chance these days of her finding a man with all his limbs attached. Don't look a gift horse. She knew also that Pardejeurs was small. There was nowhere they could get up to anything much. Dozens of eyes and ears would report the least sign of anything untoward. It surprised Tom how much he looked forward to seeing Isabel. Somehow she'd crept under his defences. He enjoyed her stories of life in Pardejeurs and its history, about how the French chosen the name for this spot between oceans because it meant good at sharing as well as dividing. She talked about the time she fell from a tree and broke her arm, the day she and her brothers painted red spots on Mrs. Mewett's goat and knocked on her door to tell her it had measles. She told him quietly and with many pauses about their deaths in the Somme and how she'd wish she could get her parents to smile again. He was wary, though. This was a small town. She was a lot younger than he was. He'd probably never see her again once he went back out to the light. Other blokes might take advantage, but to Tom the idea of honour was kind of an antidote to some of the things he'd lived through. Isabel herself could hardly have put into words the new feeling. Excitement, perhaps, she felt every time she saw this man. There was something mysterious about him, as though behind his smile he was still far away. She wanted to get to the heart of him. If the war had taught her anything, it was to take nothing for granted, but it wasn't safe to put off what mattered. Life could snatch away the things she treasured, and there was no getting them back. She began to feel an urgency, a need to seize an opportunity, before anyone else did. The evening before he was due to go back to Janus, they were walking along the beach. Though January was only 2 days old, it felt like years since Tom had first landed in Pardejeurs, 6 months before. Isabel looked out to sea where the sun was sliding down the sky and into the grey water at the edge of the world. She said, I was wondering if you'd do me a favour, Tom. Yep. What?
I was wondering, she said, not slowing her pace, if you'd kiss me.
Tom half thought the wind had made the words up. Because she didn't stop walking, he tried to work out what it could have been that she really said. He took a guess.
Of course I'll miss you, but maybe I'll see you next time I'm back on leave.
She gave him an odd look and he began to worry. Even in the dying light, her face seemed red.
I'm sorry, Isabel, I'm not too good with words, and situations like this. Situations like what? She asked, crushed by the thought that this must be something he did all the time. Girl in every port. Like saying goodbye. I'm all right on my own, and I'm all right with a bit of company. It's switching from one to the other that gets me. Well, I'll make it easy for you then, shall I? I'll just go, right now. She whipped around and started off down the beach.
Isabel!
Isabel, wait! He ran after and caught her hand. I didn't want you to just go off without, well, just go off like that. And I will do you a favour. I will miss you. You're, well, you're good to be with. And take me out to Janus. What, you want to come for the trip out? No, to live there. Tom laughed. God, you come out with some humdingers sometimes. I'm serious. You can't be, said Tom. Though something in her look told him she just might. Why not? Well, for about 100 reasons, just off the top of my head. Most obviously because the only woman allowed on Janus is the keeper's wife. She said nothing, so he inclined his head a fraction more, as if that might help him understand. So marry me. He blinked. He's... I hardly know you, and besides, I've never even... Well, I've never even kissed you, for crying out loud. At long last. She spoke as if the solution were blindingly obvious, and she stood on tiptoes to pull his head down towards her. Before he knew what was happening, he was being kissed, inexpertly, but with great force. He pulled away from her. That's a dangerous game to play, Isabel. Shouldn't go running around kissing blokes out of the blue, not unless you mean it. But I do mean it. Tom looked at her, her eyes challenging him, her petite chin set firm. Once he crossed that line, who knew where he would end up? Oh, bugger it. To hell with good behaviour. To hell with doing the right thing. Here was a beautiful girl begging to be kissed, and the sun was gone, and the weeks were up, and he'd be out in the middle of bloody nowhere this time tomorrow. He took her face in his hands and bent low as he said, "And this is how you do it," and kissed her slowly, letting time fade away. And he couldn't remember any other kiss that felt quite the same. Finally he drew back and brushed a strand of hair out of her eyes. "Better get you home or they'll have the troops after me." He slipped his arm around her shoulder and guided her along the sand. "I meant it, you know, about getting married. You'd have to have rocks in your head to want to marry me, Is. There's not much money in light keeping, and it's a hell of a job for a wife. I know what I want, Tom." He stood still. "Look, I don't want to sound patronizing, Isabel, but you're, well, quite a bit younger than me. I'm 28 this year, and I'm guessing you haven't walked out with many fellows." He would have wagered from the attempt at a kiss that she hadn't walked out with any. "What's that got to do with it?" "Just, well, don't get confused between a thing itself the first time you come across it. Think it over. I'll bet all the tea in China that in 12 months you'll have forgotten all about me." "Humour me," she said, and reached up to kiss him again. Chapter 6 On clear summer days, Janus seemed to stretch up right to its tiptoes. You'd swear it's higher out of the water at sometimes than at others. Not just because of the rising and the ebbing of the tide. It can disappear altogether in rainstorms, disguised like a goddess in a Greek myth. Or sea mists brew up, warm air heavy with salt crystals, which obstruct the passage of light. If there are bushfires, the smoke can reach even this far out, carrying thick, sticky ash, which tints the sunsets lavish red and gold, and coats the lantern room glazing with grime. For these reasons, the island needs the strongest, brightest of lights. From the gallery, the horizon stretches 40 miles. It seems improbable to Tom that such endless space could exist in the same lifetime as the ground that was fought over a foot at a time only a handful of years ago, where men lost their lives for the sake of labelling a few muddy yards as ours instead of theirs, only to have them snatched back a day later. Perhaps the same labelling obsession caused cartographers to split this body of water into two oceans, even though it's impossible to touch an exact point in which their currents begin to differ. splitting, labelling, seeking out otherness. Some things don't change. On Janus there is no reason to speak. Tom can go for months and not hear his own voice. He knows some keepers who make a point of singing, just like turning over an engine to make sure it still works. But Tom finds a freedom in the silence. He listens to the wind. He observes the tiny details of life on the island. Now and then, as if brought in on the breeze, the memory of Isabel's kiss floats into his awareness. Touch of her skin, the soft wholeness of her. And he thinks of the years when he simply couldn't have imagined that such a thing existed. Just to be beside her had made him feel cleaner somehow, refreshed. Yet the sensation leads him back into the darkness, back into the galleries of wounded flesh and twisted limbs. To make sense of it, that's a challenge. To bear witness to the death without being broken by the weight of it. There's no reason why he should still be alive, unmaimed. Suddenly Tom realizes that he's crying. He weeps for the men snatched away to his left and right, when death had no appetite for him. He weeps for the men he killed. On the lights you account for every single day. You write up the log, you report what's happened, you produce evidence that life goes on. In time, as the ghosts start to dissolve in the pure Janus air, Tom dares to think of the life ahead of him, a thing that for years has been too improbable to depend on. Isabel is there in his thoughts, laughing in spite of it all, insatiably curious about the world around her and game for anything. Captain Hasluck's advice echoes in his memory as he goes to the woodshed. Having chosen a piece of mallee root, he carries it to the workshop. Janus Rock, 15th of March, 1921. Dear Isabel, I hope this letter finds you well. I am very well. I like it out here. That probably sounds strange, but I do. The quiet suits me. There's something magical about Janus. It's like nowhere I've ever been. I wish you could see the sunrise and sunset here, and the stars. The sky gets crowded at night, and it's a bit like watching a clock seeing the constellations slide across the sky. It's comforting to know that they'll show up, however bad the day has been, however crook things get. That used to help in France. It put things into perspective. Stars had been around since before there were people. They just kept shining no matter what was going on. Think of the light here like that, like a splinter of a star that's fallen to earth. It just shines no matter what is happening. Summer, winter, storm, fine weather, people can rely on it. Better stop rabbiting on. Point is, I'm sending with this letter a little box I've carved for you. I hope it's useful. You might put jewelry in it or hair clips and whatnot. By now you've probably changed your mind about things, and I just wanted to say that is all right. You're a wonderful girl, and I enjoyed the time we spent together. The boat comes tomorrow, so I'll give this to Ralph then. Tom. Janus Rock, 15th of June, 1921. Dear Isabel, I'm writing this quickly as the boys are getting ready to leave. Ralph delivered your letter. It was good to hear from you. I'm glad you liked the box. Thank you for the photograph. You look beautiful, but not as cheeky as you are in real life. I know just where I'll put it in the lantern room so that you can see out through the window. No, it doesn't really feel all that strange, your question. If I think about it, in the war I knew plenty of fellows who got spliced on a 3-day furlough back in England, and then came straight back to carry on the show. Most of them thought they might not be around much longer, and probably so did their girls. With a bit of luck, I will be a longer-term proposition, so think carefully. I am prepared to risk it if you are. I can apply for exceptional shore leave at the end of December, so you've got time to think it over. If you change your mind, I will understand, and if you don't, I promise I will take care of you always and do my very best to be a good husband. Yours, Tom. The next 6 months passed slowly. There had been nothing to wait for before. Tom had grown so used to greeting the days as ends in themselves. Now there was a wedding date. There were arrangements to be made, permissions to be sought. In any spare minute, he would go round the cottage and find something else to put right. The window in the kitchen that didn't quite shut. The tap that needed a man's force to turn it. What would Isabel need out here? With the last boat back, he sent an order for paint to freshen up the rooms, a mirror for the dressing table, new towels and tablecloths, sheet music for the decrepit piano. He had never touched it, but he knew Isabel loved to play. He hesitated before adding to the list new sheets, two new pillows and an eiderdown. When finally the boat arrived to take Tom back for the big day, Neville Whitnish strode on the jetty ready to fill in during his absence.
Everything in order?
Hope so, said Tom. After a brief inspection, Whitnish said,
You know how to treat a light, I'll give you that much.
Thanks, said Tom, genuinely touched by the compliment.
Ready, boy?
Asked Ralph as they were about to cast off.
God only knows, said Tom. Never a truer word spoken.
Ralph turned his eyes to the horizon.
Off we go, my beauty. Got to get Captain Sherborne, MC and Bar to his damsel.
Ralph spoke to the boat in the same way Whitnish referred to the light. Living creatures, close to their hearts. The things a man could love, Tom thought. He fixed his eyes on the tower. Life would have changed utterly when he saw it again. He had a sudden pang. Would Isabel love Janus as much as he did? Would she understand his world? Chapter 7 You see? Because it's this high above sea level, the light reaches over the curve of the earth, beyond the horizon. Not the beam itself, but the loom, the glow of it. Tom was standing behind Isabel in the lighthouse gallery, arms around her, chin reaching down to rest on his shoulder. The January sun scattered flecks of gold in her dark hair. It was 1922, and their second day alone on Janus. Back from a few days' honeymoon in Perth, and straight out onto the island. It's like seeing into the future, said Isabel. You can reach ahead in time to save the ship before it knows it needs help. The higher the light and the bigger the order of the lens, the further its beam shines. This one goes just about as far as any light can. I've never been this high up in all my life. It's like flying, she said, and broke away to circle the tower once more. What do you call the flash again? There's that word.
Character. Every coastal light has a different character. This one flashes 4 times on each 20-second rotation. So every ship knows from the 5-second flash that this is Janus, not Leeuwin or Breaksea or anywhere else.
How do they know?
Ships keep a list of the lights they'll pass on their course. Time's money if you're a skipper. They're always tempted to cut the corner of the Cape, want to be the first to offload their cargo and pick up a new one. Fewer days at sea saves on crew's wages, too. The light's here to ward them off, get them pull their head in.
Through the glass, Isabel could see the heavy black blinds of the lantern room. What are they for, she asked.
Protection. The lens doesn't care which light it magnifies. If it can turn the little flame into 1,000,000 candle power, imagine what it can do to sunlight when the lens stands still all day. It's all very well if you're 10 miles away. Not so good to be 10 inches away, so you have to protect it. Protect yourself. I'd fry if I went inside it during the day without the curtains.
Come inside, I'll show you how it works. The iron door clanged behind them as they went into the lantern room and through the opening into the light itself.
This is a first order lens, about as bright as they come.
Isabel watched the rainbows thrown about by the prisms.
So pretty.
The thick central bit of glass is the bullseye. This one has 4, but you can have different numbers depending on the character. The light source has to line up exactly with the height of that so it gets concentrated by the lens.
And all the circles of glass around the bullseyes?
Separate arcs of triangular glass are arranged around the centre of the lens like rings of a dartboard.
On the first day, it refracts the light. They bend it so instead of heading up to the moon or down to the ocean floor, it's no good to anybody. It goes straight out to sea. They make it sort of turn a corner.
The rings above and below the metal bar, see? 14 of them. They get thicker the further away from the centre they are. They reflect the light back down, so all the light is being concentrated into one beam, not just going off in all directions.
So none of the light gets away without earning its keep, said Isabel.
You could say that.
Here's the light itself, he said, gesturing to the small apparatus on the metal stand in the very centre of the space, covered in mesh casing.
Doesn't look much.
It isn't now, but that mesh cover is an incandescent mantle, and it makes the vaporized oil burn bright as a star once it's magnified.
I'll show you tonight.
Our own star. like the world's just been made just for us, with the sunshine and the ocean. We have each other all to ourselves.
I reckon the lights think they've got me all to themselves, said Tom.
No nosy neighbours or boring relatives, she nibbled at his ear. Just you and me.
And the animals. There's no snakes on Jonas, luckily. Some islands down this way are nothing but. There's one or two spiders will give you a nip, though, so keep your eyes peeled. Tom was having difficulty finishing his point about the local fauna, as Isabel kept kissing him, nipping his ears, reaching her hands back into his pocket in a way that made an effort to think, let alone speak coherently. It's a serious, he struggled on. Point I'm trying to make here is, you need to watch out for, and he let out a moan as her fingers found their target. Me, she giggled. I'm the deadliest thing on this island. Not here, Iz, not in the middle of the lantern. He took a deep breath. Let's go downstairs. Isabel laughed. Yes, here. It's government property. What, are you going to have to record it in the logbook? Tom gave an awkward cough. Technically. These things are pretty delicate, and they cost more money than you or I will ever see in a lifetime. I don't want to be the one who has to make up an excuse about how anything got broken. Come on, let's go downstairs. And what if I won't? She teased. Well, I suppose I'll just have to. He hoisted onto her one hip. Make you, sweetheart. And he carried her down the hundreds of narrow stairs. Oh, it's heaven here, Isabel declared the next day as she looked out at the flat turquoise ocean. Despite Tom's grim warnings about the weather, the wind had declared a greeting truce and the sun was again gloriously warm. He had brought her to the lagoon, a broad pool of placid ultramarine, no more than 6 feet deep, in which they were now swimming. Just as well you like it. It's 3 years till we get shore leave. She put her arms around him. I'm where I want to be, with the man I want to be with. Nothing else matters. Tom swirled her gently in a circle as he spoke. Sometimes fish find their way in here through the gaps in the rocks. You can scoop them up with a net or even just with your hands. What's this pool called? Hasn't got a name. Everything deserves a name, don't you think? Well, you can give it one then. Isabel thought for a moment. I hereby christen this Paradise Pool, she said, and splashed a handful of water onto a rock. This will be my swimming spot. You're usually pretty safe here, but keep your eyes open just in case. What do you mean? Asked Isabel as she paddled, only half listening. Sharks can't usually make it through the rocks unless there's a really high tide or a storm or something, so you're probably safe on that count. Probably. But you need to be careful about other things, sea urchins say. Watch out when you're walking on submerged rocks or the spines can snap off in your foot and get infected. And stingrays bury themselves near the sand or the edge of the water. If you tread on the barb of the tail, you're in trouble. If it flicks up and gets you near the heart, well... He noticed that Isabel had gone silent. You all right, Is? Feels different somehow when you just reel it all off like that. When we're this far from help. Tom took her in his arms and pulled her up to the shore. I'll look after you, sweetheart. Don't you worry, he said with a smile. He kissed her shoulders and laid her head back on the sand to kiss her mouth. In Isabel's wardrobe, besides the piles of thick winter woolens, hang a few floral dresses. Easy to wash. Hard to hurt as she goes about her new work of feeding the chickens or milking the goats, picking the vegetables or cleaning the kitchen. When she hikes around the island with Tom, she wears an old pair of his trousers, rolled up more than a foot and cinched with a crack leather belt over one of his collarless shirts. She likes to feel the ground under her feet and goes without shoes whenever she can. But on the cliff she endures plimsolls to protect her soles from the jagged granite. She explores the boundaries of her new world. One morning, soon after she arrived, a little drunk with the freedom of it, she decided to experiment. What do you think of the new look? She said to Tom, as she brought him a sandwich in the watchroom at noon, wearing nothing at all. I don't think I need clothes on a day as lovely as this. He raised an eyebrow and gave her a half smile. Very nice. But you'll get sick of it soon enough, Is. As he took the sandwich, he stroked her chin. There's some things you have to do to survive on the offshore lights, love. Stay normal, eat at proper times, turn the pages of the calendar,
he laughed, and keep your clobber on.
Trust me, sweet.
Blushing, she retreated to the cottage and dressed in several layers. Camisole and petticoat, shift cardigan, then heaved on Wellington boots and went to dig up potatoes with unnecessary vigour in the sharp sunshine. Isabel asked Tom, "Have you got a map of the island?" He smiled.
"Afraid of getting lost? You've been here a few weeks now. As long as you go in the opposite direction of the water, you'll get home sooner or later. And the light might give you a clue, too."
"I just want a map. There must be one."
"Yeah, of course there is. There are charts of the whole area if you want them, but I'm not sure what good they are to you. There's nowhere much you can go."
"Just humour me, husband of mine," she said and kissed his cheek.
Later that morning, Tom appeared in the kitchen with a large scroll and presented it with mock ceremony to Isabel. "Your wish is my command, Mrs. Sherborne."
"Thank you," she replied in the same tone. "That will be all for now. You may go, sir."
A smile played on Tom's lips as he rubbed his chin.
"What are you up to, missy?"
"Never you mind."
For the next few days, Isabel went off expeditions each morning, and in the afternoon closed the door to the bedroom, even though Tom was safely occupied with his work. One evening, after she'd dried the dinner dishes, she fetched a scroll and handed it to Tom.
"This is for you."
"Thanks, love," said Tom, who was reading a dog-eared volume on the tying of rope knots. He looked up briefly. "I'll put it back tomorrow."
"But it's for you."
Tom looked at her.
"It's the map, isn't it?"
She gave a mischievous grin.
"You won't know until you look, will you?"
Tom unrolled the paper to find it transformed. Little annotations had appeared all over it, together with coloured sketches and arrows. His first thought was that the map was Commonwealth property and there would be hell to pay next inspection. New names had sprung up everywhere.
"Well," Isabel smiled.
"It just seemed wrong that places weren't called anything, so I've given them names, see?"
The coves and the cliffs and the rocks and the grassy fields all bore fine lettering in which they were christened, as Paradise Pool had been. Stormy Corner, Treacherous Rock, Shipwreck Beach, Tranquil Cove, Tom's Lookout, Izzy's Cliff, and many more.
"I suppose I'd never thought of it being as separate places. It's all just Janus to me," said Tom, smiling.
"It's a world of differences. Each place deserves a name like rooms in a house."
Tom rarely thought of the house in terms of rooms either. It was just home. Something in him was saddened at the dissection of the island, splitting off into the good and the bad, the safe and the dangerous. He preferred to think of it whole. Even more, he was uneasy about parts bearing his name. Janus did not belong to him. He belonged to it like he'd heard the natives thought of land. His job was just to take care of it. He looked at his wife, who was smiling proudly at her handiwork. If she wanted to give things names, maybe there was no harm in it. Maybe she would come to understand his way of looking at it, eventually. When Tom gets invitations to his battalion reunions, he always writes back. Always sends good wishes and a bit of money towards the mess, but never attends. Well, being on the lights, he couldn't even if he wanted to. There are some, he knows, who will take comfort in seeing a familiar face, retelling a story. But he doesn't want to join in. There were friends he lost, men he trusted, fought with, drunk with, and shivered with. Many understood without a word, knew as if they were an extension of his body. He thinks about the language that bound them together, words that cropped up to cover circumstances no one had ever encountered before. A pineapple, pipsqueak, plum pudding, all types of shell which might find their way into your trench. The lice were chats, the food was scran, and a blighty was a wound that'd see you shipped back to a hospital in England. He wonders how many men can still speak this secret language. Sometimes when he wakes up next to Isabel, he's still amazed and relieved that she isn't dead. He watches closely for a breath, just to make sure. Then he puts his head against her back and absorbs the softness of her skin, the gentle rise and fall of her body as she sleeps on. It is as great a miracle as he has ever seen. Chapter 8.
Maybe all the times of my life I could have done without. Maybe they're all a test to see if I deserved you, Is.
They were stretched on a blanket on the grass, 3 months after Isabel's arrival in Janus.
The April night was still almost warm and tinseled with stars. Isabel lay with her eyes closed, resting in the crook of Tom's arm as he stroked her neck. "You're my other half of the sky," he said. "I never knew you were a poet." "Oh, I didn't invent it. Read it somewhere. Latin poem, Greek myth, something like that anyway." "You and your fancy private school education," she teased. It was Isabel's birthday and Tom had cooked her breakfast and dinner and watched her untie the bow on the wind-up gramophone which he'd conspired with Ralph and Bluey to ship out to make up for the fact that the piano he'd proudly shown her when she arrived was unplayable from years of neglect. All day she'd listened to Chopin and Brahms, and now the strains of Handel's Messiah were ringing from the lighthouse, where they'd set it up to let it echo in the natural sound chamber. "I love the way you do that," said Tom, watching Isabel's index finger coil a lock of hair into a spring, then release it and start with another. Suddenly self-conscious, she said, "Oh, Ma says it's a bad habit. I've always done it, apparently. I don't even notice I'm doing it." Tom took a strand of her hair and wound it round his finger, and then let it unfurl like a streamer.
"Tell me another myth," Isabel said.
Tom thought for a moment. "You know Janus is where the word January comes from. It's named after the same god as this island. He's got two faces back to back. Pretty ugly fellow. What's he god of?" "Doorways. Always looking both ways. Torn between two ways of seeing things. January looks forward to the new year and back to the old year. He sees past and future. And the island looks in the direction of two different oceans, down to the South Pole and up to the equator." "Yeah, I'd got that," said Isabel. She pinched his nose and laughed. "Just teasing. I love it when you tell me things. Tell me more about the stars. Where's Centaurus again?" Tom kissed her fingertip and stretched her arm out until he had lined it up with the constellation. "There. Is that your favourite?" "You're my favourite. Better than all the stars put together." He moved down to kiss her belly. "I should say, you two are my favourites, shouldn't I? What if it's twins or triplets?" Tom's head rose and fell gently with Isabel's breath as he lay there. "Can you hear anything? Is it talking to you yet?" she asked. "Yep, saying I need to carry its mum to bed before the night gets too cold." And he gathered his wife in his arms and carried her easily into the cottage, as the choir in the lighthouse declared, "For unto us a child is born." Isabel had been so proud to write to her mother with the news of the expected arrival. "Oh, I wish I could, I don't know, swim ashore or something just to let them know. Waiting for the boat is killing me." She kissed Tom and asked, "Should we write to your dad, your brother?" Tom stood up and busied himself with the dishes on the draining board. "No need," was all he said. His expression, uneasy but not angry, told Isabel not to press the point, and she gently took the tea towel from his hand. "I'll do this lot," she said. "You've got enough to get through." Tom touched her shoulder. "I'll get some more down on your chair," he said, and attempted a smile as he left the kitchen. In the shed, he looked at the pieces of rocking chair he was planning to make for Isabel. He'd tried to remember the one in which his own mother had rocked him and told him stories. His body remembered the sensation of being held by her, something lost to him for decades. He wondered if their child would have a memory of Isabel's touch, decades into the future. Such a mysterious business, motherhood. How brave a woman must be to embark on it, he thought, as he considered the path of his own mother's life. Yet Isabel seemed utterly single-minded about it. It's nature, Tom. What's there to be afraid of? When he had finally tracked down his mother, he was 21 and just finishing his engineering degree. Finally, he was in charge of his own life. The address the private detective gave him was a boarding house in Darlinghurst. He stood outside the door, his gut a whirl of hope and terror, suddenly ate again. He caught the sounds of other desperations seeking out under the doors along the narrow wooden passage. A man's sobs from the next room and a shout of, "We can't go on like this," from a woman, accompanied by a baby screaming. Somewhere further off, the fervent rhythm of a headboard as the woman who lay before it probably earned her keep. Tom checked the penciled scrawl on the paper. Yes, the right room number. He scanned his memory again for the lullaby gentle sound of his mother. "Ups-a-daisy, my young Thomas. Shall we put a bandage on that scrape?"
His knock went unanswered and he tried again. Eventually he turned the handle tentatively and the door gave no resistance. The unmistakable scent rushed to meet him, but it was a split second before he recognized it as tainted with cheap alcohol and cigarettes. In the closed-in gloom, he saw an unmade bed and a tatty armchair in shades of brown. There was a crack in the window, and a single rose in a vase had long shriveled.
"Looking for Ellie Sherborne?"
The voice belonged to a wiry balding man who had appeared at the door behind him. It was so strange to hear her name spoken. He had never imagined Ellie. "Mrs. Sherborne, that's right. When will she be back?" Maine gave a snort.
"She won't. More's a pity. She owes me a month's rent."
It was all wrong, the reality. He couldn't make it fit with the picture of the reunion he'd had planned, dreamed of for years. Tom's pulse quickened. "So, do you have a forwarding address?"
"Not where she's gone. Died 3 weeks ago. I was just coming in to clear the last of her stuff out."
Of all the possible scenes Tom had imagined, none had ended like this. He stood completely still.
"You planning on moving, or moving in?"
the man asked sourly. Tom hesitated, then opened his wallet and took out £5. "For her rent," he said softly, and strode down the hallway, fighting tears. The thread of hope Tom had protected so long was snapped. On a back street in Sydney, as the world was on the brink of war. Within a month, he'd enlisted, giving his next of kin as his mother, at her boarding house address. Recruiters weren't fussy about details. Now Tom ran his hands over the one piece of wood he had lathed and tried to imagine what he might say in a letter to his mother today if she were alive. How he might tell her the news of the baby. He took up the tape measure and turned to the next piece of wood. "Zebedee." Isabel looked at Tom with a poker face, her mouth twitching just a touch at the corners. "What?" asked Tom, pausing from his task of rubbing her feet. "Zebedee," she repeated, putting her nose back down the book so she could not catch her eye. "Oh, you're not serious. What kind of a name?" A wounded expression crossed her face. "That's my great-uncle's name. Zebedee Zanzibar Graysmark." Tom gave her a look as she ploughed on. "I promised Grandma on a deathbed that if I'd ever have a son, I'd call him after a brother. I can't go back on a promise." "I was thinking of something a bit more normal. Are you calling my great-uncle abnormal?" Isabel couldn't contain herself any longer and burst out laughing.
got you good and proper.
"Little minx, you'll be sorry you did that."
"No, stop, stop."
"No mercy," he said as he tickled her tummy and her neck.
"I surrender. Too late for that now."
They were lying in the grass where it gave wreck the shipwreck beach. It was late afternoon and the soft light rinsed the sand in yellow. Suddenly Tom stopped. "What's wrong?" asked Isabel, peeping out from under the long hair that hung over her face. He stroked the strands away from her eyes and looked at her in silence. She put a hand to his cheek. "Tom?"
"Bowls me over sometimes. 3 months ago there was just you and me. Now there's this other life. Just turned up out of nowhere like a baby."
"Yes, like a baby, but it's more than that, is. When I used to sit up in the lantern room before you'd arrived, think about what life was, I mean, compared to death." He stopped himself.
"I'm talking rubbish now, I'll shut up."
Isabel put her hand under his chin. "You hardly ever talk about things, Tom. Tell me."
"I can't really put it into words. Where does life come from?"
"Does it matter?" "Doesn't matter," he queried. "But it's a mystery that we don't understand. There are times I wanted an answer, I can tell you that much. Times I saw a man's last breath and I wanted to ask him, 'Where have you gone? You were here right beside me just a few seconds ago. Now some bits of metal have made holes in your skin because they hit you fast enough and suddenly you're somewhere else. How can that be?'" Isabella hugged her knees with one arm and with the other hand pulled at the grass beside her. "Do you think people remember this life when they go? Do you think in heaven my grandma and granddad say, knocking around together?"
"Search me," Tom said.
With sudden urgency, she asked, "When we're both dead, Tom, God won't keep us apart, will he?
He'll let us be together.
Tom held her.
Now look what I've done. I should have kept my silly mouth shut. Come on. We're in the middle of choosing names, and I was trying to rescue a poor baby.